All right, Nashville Talks with Taylor Jones. That's the name of the show. We're glad you're here. If you've never been here before, we're glad you're here for the first time. Thank you if you're rejoining us again. This is a show where we talk about stuff that goes down in this city called Nashville. People from the people that live here and work here and play music here or do whatever they do here. So it's like your first-hand boots-on-the-ground account of what's going on here from the real people. Not on some TV show called Nashville, which has been really good for our town. I'm not going to bash it or nothing. It's been bad for the traffic, but it's been good for the economy. So thank you, ABC, or whoever put that show on, for bringing us a whole lot of bridesmaids. That's all I can tell you. You've brought us a whole lot of bridesmaids.
Back in the Bluebird every night.
Yes, brother. The Bluebird is thankful for you. Because the Bluebird, I remember going there when there's nobody in there. Yeah. And now that sucker is, shoot, can't even get a ticket. Hardly no more. But yeah, so that's a real thing, man. Nashville, the TV show. Packs in the Bluebird. So this is Friday, which you know what happens on Friday. We drop a show on Friday. Lord willing and the creek don't rise. We will try to drop you a show on Friday. And unless there's some kind of lazy circumstance that came through and put me behind, but the producer's keeping me on my toes over here. So I'm excited for today's show. My good buddy Ben Sparacco is in the building. He plays a mean guitar and other things, and he's also my neighbor. So when you're hurting for podcast guests, just knock on the next door. And see if the guy next door will come talk to you.
Well, that's what I did for a drummer.
Yes. That is what you did.
Actually, I knocked on your Instagram door and didn't even walk down the street. I was like, hey, man, I live two houses down. Yeah. Come over and jam.
Yes. So he did that. He hit me up on the Instagram DM or whatever. Like I instruct all of you to do with your suggestions for the podcast or your ideas or your likes and dislikes. Just hit me up on the old DM. Yeah, the Instagram is always a go-to place if you want to contact me or talk about some stuff. I really like the Instagram DM, so hit me up on there. And send your hate mail to Ian, though. Don't send that to me. Send that to the producer. He'll deal with it. So, Ben, what's it like living next door to me?
What
a question. What an egotistical question.
No, man, it's... I love living. I was just thinking about it before walking over here, how cool it is to live on this street. Because, you know, like, I mean, you know, my two roommates, Royal and Sterling Masai, who also played on the record. You played on my record. Ross Holmes produced it, who is a brother-in-law of both my roommates and lives like three houses in the other direction from me. Who else is on this street? Everybody, man. Dude. Like, it's a musical street. Like, half the guys that played on my record live.
Justin Calk is right down the hill over here, too. He's a great guitar player.
Yeah,
well.
Man. Jamie Hanna's next door to me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's cool, man. And, you know, I've only been in this neighborhood since May, you know, so it's been a fun couple months for when I've been here. I've been spending a lot of time here recently, had some time off. It's been cool. You know, it's nice. The neighbor vibe is pretty musical compared to anywhere else.
Dude, it really is. It wasn't like that when I was growing up, but I'm glad it's like that now because it is a quiet little neighborhood, and most of the houses have like a place where you can put some gear and whatever.
Not enough places in my house for the gear that I'd.
Bro, you're like a gear monster.
I am. That is.
So tell me about the Gold Top. Tell me the Gold Top story.
Yeah. So I have this 53 Gibson Les Paul Gold Top. I got it from. The original owner is 83 years old.
Good night.
His name is Bob, and I know that besides from meeting him, there's a faded little sticker on the top of the guitar. It was taken off, but you can still see the outline of the word Bob. And it's played. Like you can, it's got some history, and I'm actually the first person to play it on stage, which is kind of a weird honor to me to have, like, be the first person to really make music for other people's ears in public with that guitar because there's so much history in it. But yeah, man, I got it in Cleveland, Mississippi last year. And if you know about Cleveland, Mississippi, there's not a whole lot there except I guess some nice guitars under old guys' beds. It was actually Chris Sarton who owns Soulshine.
Yeah.
He's from that area and kind of kind of arranged the deal for me. So I'm always in debt to Chris for that, because it's an honor owning that guitar. But yeah, I've played it all around the country, with my own band, with Butch Trucks and the Allman Brothers. Just a great guitar. I like old guitars. I like Gibsons. It's got some, not issues, but it's got some love on it. It definitely, you know, I mean, you've seen it. It's got like a crack in the top that I actually just had fixed. I just got it back after a long time. But it's a great sounding guitar. And every time I pick it up, I'm humbled to hold something like that. You know, I mean, I grew up with Dwayne Allman and his gold top being like the thing for me. Like that to me is a guitar player and his guitar, and like the essence of that relationship was Dwayne and his gold top. And you know, I mean, those guitars are pretty astronomically priced for anybody.
Pretty much because of him.
Yeah, he really is like kind of to me like the gold top player.
Isn't it funny how because he had such a short run and everything he did was like lightning in a bottle or whatever, that like the freaking guitars that even looked like his, the value went up.
Absolutely.
As if there's like less of them. Which I'm sure there is to some degree, but like his career was shortened, so suddenly the value of the guitar went up.
Yeah. I mean,
that is weird.
I can't think of too many people that have, you know, that have jacked up the price of like a 57 gold top. Like I said, mine's a 53, which is still a pretty, you know, valuable guitar. And I got it for obscene price that luckily the guy was totally cool with it, because I didn't really want to, you know, I didn't want to rip off an old man that was giving me his great guitar. But I mean, it's really kind of surreal owning it, and you know, I have a lot of great guitars. Like, you know, as you said, I have definitely a pretty,
give me the rundown.
I'm a gear fiend.
Give me a rundown of some of your favorites that you have, man.
Man, my main guitar is a Dickie Bett Signature Model SG. They made Gibson Custom Shop made them a couple years ago, I think 2011 or 12. It's just a good SG. It's pretty much stock. It's in open E. I play in open E tuning most of the time. Yeah, it's a great guitar. It's nice and light. You know, I play a lot of slides. You can reach up nice and high on the frets. It's just kind of, it's been my main guitar for like 2.5 years. I got it on my 17th birthday, and it's stuck with me. I got that Les Paul. I just got a Tele from this company called K-Line outside of St. Louis that I really like. And I use an Alessandro amp. It's the same amp that Derek Trucks uses. Mine's a little bit tweaked for my taste, but George Alessandro makes them in Pennsylvania, and they're like, I mean, it's kind of like the hi-fi world of guitar amps, just real high-quality, incredible stuff. And, you know, Eric Johnson, David Gilmour, you know, there's some big guys that use those amps, and they're incredible. That's actually probably the most important part of my sound, is that amp.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. It's just nice and clean and clear.
Well, you got a great tone, and it's, you know, to be 19, you got a hell of a tone for
19. Yeah, I've spent as much time trading stuff as I do playing. No, that's actually not true. It's kind of a separate hobby. I try to keep the gear and the music different worlds.
Yeah, I feel you on that. I'm not allowed in the drum shop no more. So, for my wife. But so we clearly like our kindred spirits, because like, and Ian too, because we grew up big into the brothers and Southern rock and roll and Derek Trucks and all this stuff that you're mentioning. And like, it's just not every day that I run into somebody that's like anywhere close to our age that even like gets that stuff.
It's funny, because I literally never met a single person like that in person until I moved up here. And it seems like everybody loves the Allman Brothers up here, because I'm from South Florida, which is funny because, you know, obviously like the Allman Brothers have their thing going in Florida pretty strong. But yeah, it's funny, you know, like I grew up with it, and for a while I wasn't into it at all. You know, I kind of always heard like Ramblin' Man and Jessica, and I was like, oh, they're a country band. And, you know, this is like very young, like 12, 13. And then I got really into blues music, like B.B. King and stuff, and that just led me to the Allman Brothers. And I was like, man, this is like, you know, I actually heard Don't Want You No More. I just started listening to their first album, first song. I was like, this is totally different. And then this is like, I wish I wrote that album. You know, I mean, that album's got Dreams and Whipping Post and Blackhearted Woman and all that stuff on it. And like, for me, that was like the guitar tone, the playing, the vocal sound, the arrangements. I was like, this is crazy. And listened to probably nothing but the Allman Brothers for like, from when I was like 13 to almost 15.
Just, bro, like, I swear, they have that effect on you. There's so much material and so many different versions of so many of the same songs.
Like, I mean, just over the, not even like days apart, you can hear completely different stuff, which I've always kind of aspired to, playing with my own band. You know, what's the fun in playing something the exact same way?
Oh my gosh, dude. Man, that's a real thing for me. I hate rehearsed. Like, the show's the same every night. Like, or at least the same songs or whatever. I'm like, that sounds so lame.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because not to, you know, say anything, like, bad, but I was on tour this past summer with Butch Trux, the original drummer of the Allman Brothers, and we played the same set list pretty much every night for about 3 weeks. And it's funny, the music holds up, and, you know, I've been out of my Allman Brothers heavy phase years now. I mean, you can't listen to music, you know,
you'll burn
for
out.
That long. Yeah. You'll get burned out on it. Yeah. And luckily, I kind of have never really reached that point because it's just such great music and it's such a foundation of my playing. But, you know, we play the same songs every night. But it is cool because, you know, we play them different. And especially me and the keyboard player, Bruce Katz, who's one of the best keyboard players I've ever had the pleasure of playing with, you know, we would throw in all these teases and stuff every night. And the jams would just get further and further out, even the same songs. But, you know, that's a rare situation to me because I can't play the same songs. Like with my own band, we'll have like a different set list every time, and they hate me for it. I'll be like, man, we're going to do this tonight. And they're like, I've never heard that in my life. I'm like, and you're never going to hear it again after you play this one.
Well, that's cool, man. So you mentioned that we played on the record, me and some of the guys here on the street and everything. So what we like to do is we like to play a little sample for our listeners, just in case anybody's too lazy to go to somewhere else in iTunes, like you said, like you cleared up for me a while ago. Yeah. They're already in iTunes listening to this podcast. So you just take a lateral move over to music. And you'll be able to find the pre-order for this record today when this podcast is out. And we'll go into what's the record title and what's the song that we're going to look into right now?
Yeah, the record's called Wooden because it was originally going to be an acoustic album. It's not now.
Well, that didn't last long.
I mean, it's more acoustic than other stuff I've done. And this song that we're about to listen to is called Don't Try to Wake Me Up. And when you go and pre-order the record, you'll get this song and a song called Cypress Hotel, which features Luther Dickinson from North Mississippi All-Stars on that. So you get those two songs right away if you pre-order it.
All right, folks. Coming to you right quick, here is Don't Try to Wake Me Up.
Fell out of bed on an early Sunday morning, wondering what it was that woke me up. A knock on the door was followed by a gentle woman's voice asking, don't you think you slept enough? I pulled the sheets back over my head and tried not to listen, hoping I would drift into a dream. Would wake me and show me the illusion of my peace, but instead I hear the stomping of angry feet. Don't try to wake me up from this fantasy. Half awake I'm living my dream. Tucked away, it's all okay. Never come downstairs, never face the fears of an average day. Yesterday she fell away to make me hang upstairs. I never face the fears of an average day.
There you go, folks. That's Mr. Ben Spiracco with his song Don't Try to Wake Me Up. I had a moment of brief panic because I thought I'd told you guys the wrong song title a minute ago. But during the break, he assured me that was very close to the song title, if not the song title.
You know, I'm never really sure. I don't name the songs. I just write them.
Yeah.
I also name them, but still.
There you go. So if you liked what you heard there, the sultry slide guitar tones and blues of Mr. Ben here, go check him out. Go pre-order his stuff. It helps him a lot. Check him out on the Instagram and the Twitter, just under his name, right?
Yeah, Ben Spiracco Music. But yeah, there's not too many Ben Spiraccos running around. Man. There's one other that I can find.
Yeah, if you need any help spelling that, it'll be on the title of the podcast. So copy and paste it. We make it easy for you here, folks.
Minimal effort in the internet age. You don't have to do anything.
Yes.
Just sit there and, I mean, man, in a couple of weeks, you'll be able to just look at the computer. And
yes.
Like, that's what you want to look
yes.
at.
Yes. Just anything. So tell me about playing with Butch, man. How was that?
Man, it was great. Totally unexpected, totally last minute. And I had sat in with him many times before. There's a venue near my hometown in Florida called the Funky Biscuit. That's kind of been my stomping ground. And I mean, even still is, every time I go home, I end up playing there or sitting in with somebody there. The owner, Al Poliak, has given me a lot of good opportunities, including opening for Butch. And so my band is opening for him a couple times. And then this summer we did a little run with my band in Florida. And the last show was the first show of the Butch Trucks run. And Damon Fowler, their normal guitar player, he was in the hospital. He's fine now, thank God. And they needed me to fill in for that gig. I got a call at like 6 a.m. that morning. They're like, man, can you play this gig? And I was like, let me see if I know how to play Allman Brothers music. Which is a joke, because that's like all I knew how to play for a long time. So I did the gig. It was cool. And like I said, I'd played with them before. And then they were like, we might need you for the rest of this Florida run, which was like a Tampa show and a Tallahassee show. Next morning, I got the call. And I was supposed to drive back up here to Nashville like the next day. So I ended up just like taking a detour, playing a night in Tampa, playing a night in Tallahassee. Then I drove back from Tallahassee to Nashville, and I get back, and they're like, hey, fly out to D.C. and do like a little, like four shows there. I think it was like a couple Maryland shows and Albany. And I was like, yeah, great. It was supposed to be four shows. So I packed my stuff. I was literally home for like 12 hours and didn't even bring my computer, because I was like, oh, I'll be back in a little bit. I ended up being on the road for like 22 days, totally slacked on booking a bunch of gigs, which is kind of why I did this record, because I had a bunch of time. But it was really cool. You know, I was like almost stranded on the road with like a bunch of dudes playing Allman Brothers music, which is like definitely not a bad thing in my book. Mm. But it was really cool. You know, like, there's something to be said for turning around and seeing the dude that played on all your favorite records behind you playing the songs with him. And, you know, he was very gracious to me, and just a fun guy to work with. Everybody in that band is really, really cool. And it's just, you know, it's cool. And that to me is like the ultimate player gig for me, because that was like my dream when I was 15, was playing at the Allman Brothers. And, you know, all I had to do is I took a plane, met up with a bus, and, you know, woke up when we got to the venue, played a bunch of songs, played lead guitar on, like, my favorite songs, and and that was it, and it was cool. And,
got paid for it.
Yeah, got paid for it. I would have done it for well, let's not say I'd do it for free.
Hey, I'd have done the playing part. I mean, I'd have done the playing part for free, but you got to pay me to get in that bus.
Yeah, there you go. But, yeah, it was a great experience, and, you know, I have an EP out. Put an EP out in May called Bring the Jubilee. And, you know, I sold a bunch of those, and just, it was nice. You know, it was good networking on my behalf, and it was a very satisfying gig to play. And the longest I'd been on the road, playing a lot of cities I've never been in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cool, man. I've definitely really, really appreciate that opportunity.
Well, that's sweet, man. Like, pretty cool video footage of you playing, like, Statesboro and some of those songs, and there's Butch back there shuffling with you.
Yeah, man, there's a video. I think I posted it. Of us playing BB King's in Times Square, and we're doing whipping post, like a long whipping post. And the whole time I'm telling Butch, I'm like, I'm not getting off the road with you until we play Mountain Jam. Mm. And for those that don't know, Mountain Jam is like a 30-minute song. So I knew we were never going to do like 30 minutes of Mountain Jam, because, you know, that's when a venue pulls the plug on you. But we were playing Whipping Post in New York City, and that was like, you know, that's the New York City gig. Everyone wants to kind of play their best there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had a real vague plan of how to do Whipping Post in New York City, and I'm doing my solo in Mountain Jam, and I just turned to everybody, and I'm just like, and if by some, like, work of God, everyone is like, okay, that means Mountain Jam. Everyone was on the same.
He turned around and says, E.
Everyone is on the same page, and we did it. You know, we did the first half. Mm-hmm. And there's a video of that, and it's cool. You can see, you know, Butch, like, kind of dig in a little bit. It was funny. I think I noticed that he kind of likes to be challenged.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think every musician likes to be challenged. They should, at least. But it was cool that, you know, he's still, like, he could ride on his legacy for the rest of his life and just, you know, I mean, he could half-ass it if he wanted to. But, I mean, there would be nights when he would get off stage and, like, just drained. And that's cool to see him still doing that. You know, I mean, we're playing small theaters and clubs and stuff. And, like, the last time I was in New York City before playing there, I was seeing him play at the Beacon at one of the last Allman Brothers shows. So it's cool. You know, he's still got the fire and he's still likes to take risks. And that was his whole thing. You know, he really likes to take risks, and I'm all about that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you go a little too far and it's hard to get back. And luckily that never really happened. But yeah, it was cool. It was nice to still be able to, you know, kind of have that Allman Brothers spirit there. Mm-hmm. You know, the original, like, Dwayne Allman Brothers spirit, where they can really go out, and to be able to do that with Butch and everybody else in the band too. Barry Oakley's son was playing bass. And Bruce Katz on keys, Heather Gillis on guitar, Garrett Dawson on percussion, Valor Trucks on guitar for a lot of the gigs, which is Butch's son. He's on the cover of Brothers and Sisters, the little kid with the stick in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. If I am, I'm sorry.
That's awesome. Well, I'll tell you, man, every interview I've ever heard with him, he's, you know, the spirit of Dwayne Allman's approach to music and just improvising is still very much in him.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet, I think, everybody that's in the Allman Brothers that's alive, except for Dickie Betts. And I think, you know, that he just is one of those guys that just seemed to have such a lasting impression. I mean, I can't get it because I never met him. I don't think anybody can. But I mean, it's really inspiring to me to have everybody be like, man, this is the guy that he, you know, it's crazy that everybody that met him, it kind of has the same opinion of him just being so incredible, you know, and as a player and a person. Yeah. And that's something that I think everybody should want to live up to in one way or another.
Yeah. And somehow he got it done. And it's just amazing. Like, I remember you told me the story about when Butch saw, like, the big poster or whatever of Dwayne in the back. Yeah, what venue was that?
We were playing. Oh, I wish I could remember the name. It was in like Lakeland, Florida. I think it's the Music Farm, the Music Ranch. Old place. It's kind of like an old honky tonk. And there's just a picture of Dwayne in the back. And, you know, before the show, this is like my second show on the run with him. And he just looks at Dwayne. He was wearing a Dwayne Allman shirt. And he's like showing the, you know, he's like, man, this is for you. Like still for playing for Dwayne, you know, since the day he died. And I mean, probably since before then too, you know. I mean, he's always been kind of trying to prove himself to Dwayne, and I think that's incredible, man. I mean, it's been, what, 45 years to still have that, you know, just a picture of him and just be really, you know, inspired to go on stage from that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I couldn't imagine, like, that's leadership quality, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he was a good leader. He made an impression, and he led by example, and he followed it up with the right kind of encouragement or whatever, and challenging the other people, and he made all them guys, all them old rednecks, play better than they probably ever could have.
Except the other way around too. Pretty good. I mean, man, that band, they were firing on all cylinders, which was a lot of the time. You know, they were pushing him to. I mean, there's things that I've heard Dwayne do. You know, just straight out of like the book of Coltrane licks in the middle of a whipping poster, Memory of Elizabeth Reed, or whatever it is. And it's cool to listen to, man. You know, I'll go back and listen to it. And I don't really listen to it that much anymore. But I actually, just last night, I was listening to a version of In Memory of Elizabeth Reed from, I want to say, February 11th, 1970. It was a show that they did with the Dead at the Fillmore East. And I mean, man, he's a good guitar player.
Yeah.
It's just, it's nuts. You know, you can hear these different things. Like, you know, like we were saying, having shows be different. They were definitely masters of that. I mean, so were the guys that they were copying too. I mean, all that music is derivative of something else in some way. And I mean, so is kind of everything. But man, yeah, you know, they did it right. And they did up until the end. You know, like, I was at the third to last Allman Brothers show. Derek and Warren definitely are no slouches compared to, you know, 1971 Dwayne and Dickie.
Yeah, man. It's, I love the family aspect too of that group. It's like,
man, Butch's, like I said, his son Valor was out, and his daughter was out at the Florida shows, grandkids. It was really like a family affair, you know, in addition to the actual like Allman Brothers family feel. So that was cool too.
Yeah, man. Well, it's an influential band on a lot of people, you know, and it's cool that there's some of us younger guys that can carry it on or whatever, like the old stories, and smartening our kids up to music that will be, you know, geez, 70 years old by then, probably, you know, who knows.
That's crazy.
But God bless them. So you're from Florida. Did you just grow up playing guitar, or how'd you get started?
I don't really know. You know, my parents always liked good music. Grew up with the Beatles. That was kind of like what was always playing in my house. You know, my dad grew up most of his like teenage years in Florida. And like our dads are about the same age.
Yeah.
And I know your dad's real into the Allman Brothers and a lot of, you know, great music from that era. So is mine. And, you know, I got my first guitar when I was 4 on my 4th birthday. Apparently I asked for it, but, you know, I was 3, I guess, when I asked for it, so I don't really remember. And I just never really put it down. You know, I didn't know what I was doing for years, but it was there and it was in my hands, and it was just, you know, something that was part of my life. And, you know, just kind of kept going. Took lessons when I was a kid. Started gigging when I was like 11. It wasn't until I was really like 12 that I heard B.B. King and Freddie King.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, okay, this is what I've been like trying to do. I just didn't know where it was.
Yeah.
You know, how many 11, 12-year-old kids in South Florida in, you know, whatever year that was, like 2010 or 2009, are going to hear that and be like, that's a thing.
You know?
Like, it's not really something that you hear too much in that situation. But I just kind of went from there. But it's always been a part of my life, you know. It's been there, and it was a hobby for a while. There were always other things that I did. Like, I was really into skateboarding when I was little. I used to ride motocross until I realized that, like, if you fall from, like, 50 feet in the air, you're going to break your hands and not be able to play guitar.
Your hands. You're going to break your hands.
Well, you know.
You might break your ass, but I'd hate for you to break your hands.
That's what I'm saying. You know, I can break anything else, you know. Break my legs, I'll sit down, whatever, it's fine. But, like, break my wrist or my hands, then I'm going to have a problem.
You're crazy, man. That's hilarious. Have you ever worked like a regular job or anything?
No, that's awesome. I've taught on and off at a School of Rock. Are you familiar with the School of Rock? I went there when I was a kid, for a long time actually, and met like a lot of good friends there. And I would like help out at their summer camps and stuff and teach them lessons. But no, I have not had a regular job.
That's good.
I want to keep it that way if I can. That's kind of the goal. You know. Music. It's cool.
That's cool, man. I think you can do it. I think you have to be those kind of one of that type of person that's like, you know, willing to try it, you know, and avoid a job at all costs.
Yeah. I mean, I dropped out of school in April to do music. I was never there, so it kind of made sense. But, you know, I definitely went all in this year, and it's working out pretty well. You know, it was very much a year of setting things up and kind of like, you know, pre-playing 2017. So I'm curious how, you know, if it'll turn out as well as it looks like it might turn out next year, you know, as far as touring and kind of get my name out there goes.
Well, you just got to start somewhere. So,
well, we're starting right here in your backyard.
in the podcast room. So moving to Nashville was like to go to Belmont, right? And that was really just probably trying to get to Nashville.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was always not a fan of school. I was always good in school, but I was always just wanted to play music. So I remember in high school, I like told one of my friends, I was like, I really don't want to ever graduate high school. And then, but I mean, you got to graduate high school at least. And, you know, I did well in school. So it kind of would have been like a waste if I didn't even graduate high school. And then my parents were like, you don't have any major touring going on right now. So you got to go to college because like, you can't live in our house.
You
got to pay and like live on your own and try to just do something. And I was like, I guess I'll go to college. Like, cause if you're going to do something, that's probably a good idea. So I went to Belmont because if I'm going to go to college, that was a great school. And you know, that was definitely the right choice, but I went because I love Nashville when I visited. And you know, I kind of knew going there cause I started my band the day before I moved up here. And unfortunately, fortunately for me, but unfortunately for like people that wanted me to go to college, it took off pretty quickly. And we had a bunch of, you know, opening gigs and stuff. So I ended up flying back and forth between Nashville and Florida for the first couple months that I lived up here, and was just missing so much class that they were like, hey, you can't do this. Like, you gotta choose.
When you come to school, you actually have to come to
school. Yeah, which was a surprise to me. So, but, you know, it's funny because I was a music major. I was a guitar major. And they were like, man, you got to show up to your guitar lessons. And I'm like, I'm playing guitar. Like, I'm literally leaving to play guitar. And I mean,
paid.
I can't blame them. You know, they got to, like, if they didn't let people, if they were cool with people not going to class, then nobody would.
Right.
But yeah, I came up here and I left before it would have, like, counted as me failing school.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I left in April, so, like, during my second semester. And went home for a little bit and played some gigs. And then came back up here in May. And it's been interesting not going to school because I'm still very young.
Yeah.
I'm 19, and, like, most people that I know, everybody that I know really, is going to school. That's my age. I lose track of how old I am.
Yeah.
Because to me, I'm still a freshman in college.
Yeah.
But, like, all my friends are not. So I'm like, what year was I born? When is that, like, how old are people that are in, like, high school? It's weird. Like, that was my judge of how I, like, can see time. And now I wake up, I'm like, okay, time to play guitar and book gigs and make a record.
Dang.
It's just such a weird shift.
So tell me about going from the acoustic record to whatever it was that we ended up with.
All right. Well, in my living room, I have an acoustic guitar, the acoustic guitar that I played like the whole record on, just sitting next to my couch. And like I mentioned before, I totally slacked on booking gigs when I was out with Butch. And we were out like mid-July through mid-August, which is kind of like prime fall booking time. So I was totally, like, had nothing going on this fall. And I got back, and even actually starting on that run, I was writing these songs, and I kind of wanted, like, I had this thing where we were on the bus, and I really wanted to psych myself out from, like, player music, you know, because we were doing all this just, like, real lead-heavy music. I mean, it's Allman Brothers music. So I started listening to a lot of, like, Americana music and acoustic folk stuff. I've always been a huge, huge Bob Dylan fan, and, you know, got back into another Bob Dylan phase and a lot of like modern kind of indie and like alternative stuff just to cleanse my palate every night. So I had that, and I got back and I, you know, had these song ideas. And then when I got back after, I think, just having, you know, experience of being on the road, songs just started like pouring out. I was like, man, where are these coming from? Songs that are different from what I had written before, much more deep in the lyrical aspect. Not deep, that's a kind of pompous way of saying that, but you know, at least a little bit more involved lyrically, and you know, less focused musically, especially because I was writing them on acoustic guitar, which I'd never really done before. So I got to the point where I had like four songs and no gigs coming up, and I was like, man, I just need to like kind of stay relevant and do something and put something out. So I was like, I'll do an acoustic EP, you know, four or five songs, and just do it quick and dirty, you know, find a home studio or something to do it at. And then I got the idea to call Ross Holmes up, another neighbor, to produce it. And, you know, Ross plays with Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers and toured with Warren Haynes for a while and did all this string arranging on the Mumford & Sons record, Babel. So, you know, I knew that he would know acoustic music because I had never really been that deep in acoustic music before. And every time I've tried, I've always wanted to put drums on it or put, you know, more than I really needed to in it. So I kind of called him and I was like, you are going to be kind of like my seatbelt. You're going to hold me back from doing what we ended up doing.
Oh.
And it's kind of funny that it worked out that way because, you know, Ross is an incredible bluegrass musician and plays with all these guys that, you know, I know he knows how to make songs come across without using too much. But then it kind of just, I can't think back of how it worked, but it just blossomed into this thing where obviously like, you play drums on most of the songs. You know, I played electric guitar on a lot, electric bass, you know, keyboards and stuff. I was doing some like synth stuff. I was using an Omnicord on a few songs. I don't really remember how it happened. And it went from being like a 4-song acoustic EP to a 10-song electric full length record. And I'm really happy it did. Like I absolutely am thrilled with everything that came from those sessions. And, you know, Ross had a big part in producing it and making it sound like it did. But yeah, I'm not really sure what happened there. It just happened. And
well, I like the evolution of it. Yeah. It was like, once you get in there, you're like, well, let's just go ahead and do this. And if you don't like it, you can always just not use totally. It. And you know,
the vibe in the studio was just so right too. I haven't done a full live record, really. I mean, ever in a serious, in a serious way. You know, I've always just done sessions for other people and overdub stuff, or you know, never done like a full live band. And it was really right. You know, we did it at the Bomb Shelter in East Nashville with John Estes. Yeah, incredible studio. Lots of great records have come out of there. And it just felt right. You know, I got in there. The first song I recorded was the last song on the record, and it was just me playing acoustic guitar and singing. And it's the only song that was like that. And that was the plan for the original EP, was just all of that. And I was just sitting in there, and I was like, yeah, this is right. You know, this is cool. And at this point, I had already asked you to come out like 2 days later. And I was worried. I was like, man, I really hope this doesn't end up just being like a huge jumble of garbage once we get everybody on it, you know, because I'd never heard the songs with more instruments. Yeah. They were all just acoustic songs. But once I was in the studio and I had Ross and John with me the first day, I was like, this is going to work. And kind of even we had a day off after that. We did one day and then, or maybe 2 days. And then the full band came in. And I had these ideas just from the space, and I was like, yeah, you know, we can do this. We can make a record and do something that I think is different. I mean, I've never heard anything exactly like it. I've heard a lot of stuff that, you know, all the stuff that I kind of ripped off, like all the stuff that influenced it. But, you know, I think it's interesting. It's pretty varied. I think there's a lot of songs that kind of go in one direction, a lot that go in another direction, and all of it's different than everything I've done before.
Well, cool, man. Well, it was sure enough a lot of fun to... So it was me and Royal, and Sterling played on some.
Yeah, Sterling played banjo. Ross produced it and played fiddle and mandolin. Who else? John Estes played bass and keys on a few songs.
Everything's analog, too.
Everything's analog. A couple overdubs we did in a Logic session, but for the most part, we'll just say everything's analog. It sounds better that way.
It was. I was like, tape.
Yeah, well, that was my first time recording onto tape, too. Yeah. I've like mastered to tape before. Who else was up? Man, had two girl singers out to do backup vocals, Vicky Vaughn and Paige England. And who else? Kai Welch played trumpet on a song.
What a beast.
I think that's it. Andrea, who owns the Bomb Shelter, it's his studio. He mastered it. Did an incredible job. I've actually never mastered my own stuff before.
Yeah.
I've always just kind of like half-assed it and been like, all right, here's a real good mix. We'll run it through tape, you know, run it through a good compressor. Because I've never done a full-length album before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the masters back, and, you know, he does the masters to tape and does, you know, real deal stuff. And I'm like, whoa, this is like really different in a really good way. It was cool. It really opened my eyes to the value of mastering. Thank God it did, because I paid a lot of money for it.
Yeah. True.
But yeah, it's cool, man. When I got it back, and John's been incredible to work with. John Estes, you know, and he's a great bass player too. We actually, I can't say much about it, but we have something going on in late February. Another kind of, it's interesting. You'll find out about it if you choose to follow me on various platforms.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah, there
folks.
We go. I'll just leave you guys with that tidbit of almost information.
Of almost information. Well, that was cool the other night, too, when you came and set in with the Midnight Riders. That was fun.
Yeah, that was fun. That was actually the first time I played Allman Brothers music since I got off the road with Butch.
Really?
And, like, the first time I'd even heard it. Wow. And it was, you know, what's really funny about that is I set in with the Blues Apostles.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, Midnight
Gary
Riders.
Gary and
him. Yeah. So, set in with your dad. He tuned his SG up to open E for me. And I played Statesboro Blues with them. And, like, it's cool. You know, I always appreciate sitting in. But, like, that is the song that everybody asks me to sit in with their band on.
Are you
because
serious?
Because everyone's like, you know, you're like, you like the Allman Brothers. You know, I've toured with this dude before. And you play a slide. So that's, like, kind of, I mean, for me, Statesboro Blues has always been kind of, like, the go-to slide song. That's what I learned how to play slide on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, that and One Way Out. And, like, they're both great songs, obviously. But it was funny because when I went and saw Midnight Riders, I was like, you know, you guys sounded fantastic. And I walked in during Statesboro Blues. And, you know, you had mentioned that I'd probably end up sitting in. So I just walked up to say hi to your dad. And I was like thinking, you know, the only Allman Brothers song that I really want to play right now would be Ain't Wasting Time No More. Because I love that song. And I love playing slide on it. But that's not like a go-to song for any Allman Brothers tribute band, I think, especially for guests to sit down. So I just walk up to say hi to your dad, and he hands me his guitar. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm playing right now. And I'm like, what song? He's like, Ain't Wasting Time No More. I was like, what just happened? What is this?
The
this
Lord,
is like a weird
man.
Allman Brothers related prayer that has
yes.
been answered.
The Lord took care of you, bro.
Yeah, it was funny. And that was fun, man. That was the first time that we've ever played together on stage.
Mm-hmm. That was
the only
cool.
time.
Well, I was, you know, I was in there hanging on for dear life trying to play those J-Mo
parts. You were doing it.
I was doing it. Doing it all right. Felt good about it. It was a lot of fun, but it was so cool because, like, to me, like, I learned a ton about music history and just, you know, whatever, performance and playing and all that from being around the guys that I was playing with that night with my dad and his crew. But then, like, I also felt, too, like, when you got up there and it was, like, me and you, then it was this real image of, like, okay, here's the next generation of guys.
It definitely, like, a very visual passing of the torch of
yes.
sorts.
Like, kind of in a weird way. And
yeah,
like,
especially with you playing with your dad, too. You know, like, that's really cool. And it was cool to kind of, well, I mean, I've actually still never played with your dad.
Because he always has to get down. Yeah.
He hands me his guitar, and I hate, like, kicking people off stage, but, you know, he's the one that invites me up. But, yeah, you know, it was cool watching you and your dad play, and then, you know, me getting up and kind of, taking his place for a song.
Yeah.
Well, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I feel like we're at an interesting point in time where there is that music and, you know, jazz music, all these classic forms of music that you and I have grown up listening mm-hmm. to are shifting, and they're now going to have to be owned by our generation, which is in some ways a scary thought because, I don't, you know, like you said, there's not a whole lot of people our age that are, you know, that are trying to do it.
More for us.
Yeah, that's true.
You
more
know,
for us.
More responsibility for us.
It is a responsibility. That's how I've always kind of worded it. It is a responsibility for sure.
I think so.
And it's a responsibility I consider myself blessed to have on me.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's, I don't know. There's definitely worse responsibilities. But like you said, I mean, when we were there that night and I was like kind of playing in between, you know, Gary was holding it down. I was playing all the in-between stuff. And I really got to sit around and just kind of take it all in because it wasn't like, I had to worry about every little beat, you know. It was very relaxed, and I was like, "Man, here's a guy who's 19, who I remember when I was 19, you know, and younger than that even playing this. That's like that music is so it just stands up. It's always educational. It's always to me like you can put Allman Brothers music up there. It was like some kind of a modern day version of rock and roll history." Almost like classical music for rock and roll set.
Absolutely. And nothing has been the same. And nothing, you know, there's obviously people that have emulated it in some way or another. I mean, me included in that.
Well, and when you see the Zesky Trucks group, too.
Yeah, totally. Like, I think they're the best touring band in the world right now.
They're unbelievable.
I know that for a fact. You know what? Like, people will have their different opinions, but I mean, I think they are just incredible. And they definitely carry on that spirit without playing the same music.
Yep.
You know, and I know a lot of people will disagree or whatever. But
when you go to see them, like, tell me what you think about this. But it's like hippie church.
It is. It has a very church-like feel.
Like worshipy.
It really is. Yeah. And, I mean, I've been very fortunate to get close with a lot of those guys in that band. They couldn't be sweeter people, guys and girls. But, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously – it's no secret that Derek Trucks is my favorite living guitar player. And it really is like a church-like experience. They know that, too. And I think they really put effort into their music every single night. I just saw them 2 weeks ago in Louisville. Yeah. And
what venue?
The Palace.
Okay.
Louisville Palace. Great venue. Super cool.
I saw them at Ryman a couple... Well, that was in January or something.
No, it was March, and I missed it. I was on the road with my band, and funny is we actually played up here the same night. They were at one of the three nights we played at Soulshine.
Oh, really?
And I missed it, and they were like, I was going to go there after my show, and then like some of them were going to try to get a Soulshine after theirs, but it just didn't work out. And I think I went by the Ryman after my show and caught a few of them. But
yeah.
But I'm going to make an effort to definitely go to those runs.
When you go to the Ryman, man, it's like, that place is like church anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, it literally is church.
Yeah, it's like, dude, it's crazy. That's the second time I've seen him there, and with my dad and me and my brother, my dad went, and Man, it was cool, but they're insanely good. Like, bands like them and bands like the Punch Brothers, like, yeah. You see those bands and you're like, holy cow, this is the next level. This is not, like, just a bunch of
bums. You know, obviously, like, all those bands are older than us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I still consider them... It's weird to say this because I'm obviously younger than them, but, like, they're kind of the younger generation.
Yep. Well, they are.
Sure. I mean, they are. Yeah, and there's a lot of great bands. I mean, the Wood Brothers, I'm a huge fan of. They're also... are great. Dawes is one of my favorite current bands. And you know, these bands, you can buy one of their records and be like, this was made, you know, now. And it's not like you're listening to something that is purposely nostalgic,
right?
But it just draws so well, all these bands from what we grow up listening to and from the great music of, you know, 40 50 60 years ago. And I mean, I think that's kind of that's my goal. I mean, I hope that this record sounds like it was made in 2016. I mean, some of it is very clearly inspired by things long before, you know, today's music. But I think that's, like, an interesting thing. You know, there's a lot of bands that with great fan bases that are, like, kind of ride on this nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because, you know, baby boomers want to hear this music and they have the money to spend on live music.
Exactly.
And they kind of, it's weird. I think we're at an interesting point in the music business where, you know, at least in our kind of section of the music business, baby boomers are really driving the sales.
Yeah.
They're the money behind it. They're kind of the money behind a lot of things, you know, including like guitar collecting, which I am, you know, obviously like all too familiar with. But it's interesting that I feel like historically, like, music sales have been driven by people our age.
Yep.
And now it's kind of shifting a little bit.
Crazy?
Yeah. And I think it's also the way we listen to music. You know, we're streaming music. I try to buy as much music as I can.
Right, right.
But I mean, real like physical sales of, like, units of records online or otherwise, it tends to be older people. And that's why, you know, I kind of like, and I've played to old people that are older than me my entire life. I can count on one hand the amount of times I've played to people like my age.
Right, right.
And it would be like one finger on that hand, which is fine and it's cool. But I kind of lately have been a little tired of that, not because it's a bad crowd, but because there is a merit to making something that sounds of your time.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and those bands that we love and the bands that people older than us love sounded of their time. That's why they listen to them. You know, you always want to listen to stuff that reminds you of your childhood or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been like this push and pull for me is like, how do I have this responsibility of carrying on this great music, but how do I also make it sound like I'm not trying to make a record in like 1971?
Right.
You know, which I don't know if I've figured that out yet.
Well, you're getting there, brother. You're getting closer, and you're putting in the work and doing big stuff. So,
trying, man.
Playing your tail off, man. Like, it's crazy because, like, my favorite thing to play is, like, you know, is guitar solos. Like, playing behind guitar solos that build, you know? Like, starting at the bottom. Like, with Ain't Wasting Time, you start way down and you build up to the end, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, to tell that story with the lead instrument, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is, or whatever the lead instrument is, but especially a guitar, and with a guy that can really rip it, you know, like that's just the juice, man. That's just where it is.
That sounds like something a good drummer would say.
Yeah.
They like playing behind guitar solos.
Yeah. Well, I swear that's
I
always,
totally get what you're saying, but
that's always been my favorite part of the song. And honestly, to a detriment to some point, cause I didn't care about the lyrics or I didn't care about, you know, structure. It was just like, once we get the solo, we're there.
That's what happened to me. And we were talking about this at the Whistles and Bells show this past weekend, that, you know, obviously we're both players. I came from a player background. You know, I was always listening to jazz stuff, you know, guitar players. And for me, like, the longest time I spent, like, my end goal was to master the instrument and just get deeper in it than anybody else in some way that nobody else has. Because that's what my influences always did. You know, whether it's Coltrane, Miles, Derek Trucks, Jimmy Herring.
Yeah.
They're all guys that you look at them and they're like, these guys are nuts. Like, they can really play. And I still, you know, to some extent, that is, I am a guitar player before anything else. And I think I always will be. But, you know, I was listening to all these great songs on the road this summer and I was like, you know, songs are cool.
Yeah.
Like, I should write some of those. And I've always written songs and I've always loved songwriters. But, you know, I finally had a chance to really sit down and write them. And I don't really like to write, like, introspective songs. I like to write stories.
Yeah.
I've always liked that, you know, even in a non-musical kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this record is really about. It's kind of a shift from, let's play, you know, go nuts, to let's put some songs on a record.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm really proud of. It's weird to me, like, the longest song is under 5 minutes.
Right. Which a lot of people freak out when you say, like, when I tell people, you know, when I was telling my friends about, you know, going to play in this Allman Brothers set, I'm like, yeah, some of the songs are like 10 minutes or more.
You know, that's like, I mean, not even that long.
No,
to me.
No, like, we're used to playing for 25, 30 minutes. Like, on one song, we don't care because it's the journey to get there.
Yeah.
Like, the reason why you like a mountain jam is because of all the evolutions in it.
Exactly. And, you know, and it is the journey. I mean, like, it's like the old saying, you know, the journey is always, you know, better than the destination.
But, like, dude, and this, especially in Nashville, they're like, if it's over like 4 minutes, they're like, whoa, what's wrong? Yeah. That'll never get. What are you doing for, you know?
Absolutely.
And you can't hardly convince people unless it's either they get it or they don't. You know, like, they either get that style of playing or they don't, you know. And I just think there's a lot of freedom in, you know, kicking it around, and everybody on stage is going to take a solo.
Yeah, there is.
In the same song.
You know, and what's funny is that's totally how I think of it. But I heard, you know, Phil Lesh, when he gives people solos, he doesn't really use the term solo. And it's kind of it's instrument. I don't know what he does use instead of solo, but he doesn't really refer to like guitar solos as solos because it's a whole band thing. Like you were saying before, following with the drummer, you know, I mean, it's very easy to just have a guitar solo over something happening, you know, get louder. And it's not about getting louder and softer. You know, there's tempo changes involved with really making organic music and speaking with the solo and writing a song with a solo. And you know, that's the fun of it. That's what takes 10 minutes. You know, you can't have that stuff. Yep. I mean, you can do it obviously in less, but depending on the song, if it just is breathing, you don't rush it, you know, like, and I feel like that's what a lot of pop music does to me. It's very rushed. It's like instant gratification.
Get to the hook as fast as you can.
Here's your chorus right away. And Ross, mentioned to me, and actually we did some of this on my record because there are some pop elements on the record, you know, maybe not in the truly modern sense, but he said that pop songs, every 20 to 30 seconds, you hear something new, which I think is, again, that kind of thing, but you don't build into it. Every 20 or 30 seconds, that's like one note in a good guitar solo, you know, if you're letting it breathe. And I think there's an interesting thing that there's a shift in like instant gratification musically. With pop music, I guess it's kind of always been like that, but you know, it is interesting that because I'll, like you said, you know, I'll talk to someone my age and I'll be like, yeah, you know, this song's like 7 minutes, and they're like, that's crazy. That's my entire life that I've spent listening to that song, and I'm like, man, listen to like Mountain Jam or whatever, you know, like a bunch of Coltrane stuff. Like,
yeah,
that's 10-12 minutes.
And it's, yeah, dude, that's exactly. I track with that exactly. I mean. It was like, dude, if you see a 20-minute whiffing pose, you knew some stuff went down.
Yeah.
You know what
I
mean?
Or something broke.
Yeah. Something went down.
Yeah.
Like, something happened. And that's what, like, when I would see that, I'm like, oh. If it was like a 10-minute one, I'd be like, oh, they must have been ready to go.
Yeah.
Like, it must have been phoned
funny,
in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's totally how it is. There's actually an Allman Brothers show that it's like a State University of New York one, 71, so a very late Dwayne show. And one of the discs is just Dreams and Elizabeth Reed. They're both like 20 minutes long. And both of those songs are usually in like the maybe 10-minute range tops.
Yep.
So I'm like, something is going on. So Dreams, 20 minutes, and it's just the best Dreams you'll ever hear. It's 20 minutes of just really spacious, nice, textural jamming. And then Elizabeth Reed, someone's amp blew up. So you know it's one of the two. They're either having a really good time or something's on fire.
I love that, man. Oh, man. Oh, that's a cool time in music. Well, what's next for you, brother?
We're heading out on the road. Well, the record comes out January 13th. We have the pre-order coming out today.
Today.
And, the record comes out. We're going to do some record release shows. I'm kind of finishing up as like playing with the Ben Sparacco Band, my current band, which is like a four-piece kind of jazz rock jam band sort of thing. And then starting right after the 28th is our last gig. With that, it kind of is going to be the Ben Sparacco thing. And I'm going to start doing the material on this record.
Yeah.
So what do we have going on? We're playing one of the release shows is yet to be announced in Nashville, and then one on January 15th is cool. We're playing the Sunshine Music Festival after party in Florida, which is like near my hometown, and that's a Tedeschi Trucks hosted thing. So that, you know, gonna have some special guests out. Luther Dickinson, like I said, played on one of the songs. He's at that festival, so it's just gonna be a party. Ross is there playing with Bruce Hornsby. So it's going to be a real fun thing. And then we head on the road in February. We're doing like a little mid-Atlantic, you know, kind of going out East Tennessee and then North Carolina up to Philly and then back. And that should be announced fully soon on my website, just BenSparacco.com.
Cool, man.
And, you know, Facebook and all that stuff. And then we'll just be on the road from there for the rest of next year, hopefully, if things work out as I hope they are.
All right. Well, the record's called Wooden. Go seek it out. Go purchase it and join old Ben on all the social medias and join his team. Really awesome musician, man. Like, in the truest sense, like, the guy can play. I have a lot of fun watching him and playing a little bit with him. So I hope you guys will give it a shot. Thank you, Ben, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
For this week, we've had a good one. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend, and we'll look forward to talking some more later. Bye-bye.